Good morning, everybody. First of all, I'll go through some of what we know about the relationship between human health and climate change, what could be the health sector response, and then some experience of a project that we're currently undertaking in Dominica, and then some final thoughts. So the relationship between human health I'm talking about, if I forget the word human, please know that when I talk about health, I'm talking about human health. Environmental changes is extremely complex, and we don't fully understand quite a lot of it, but what we do know is that there are enormous numbers of interconnections, and it needs to be looked at from quite a broad perspective, because there isn't any sort of only unidirectional relationship of just two things. It's a very complex web of interrelationships. There are many different dimensions of the change, going from individual needs to the social needs and basic needs that we all have, and this relationship between economic, environmental, and social dimensions is something that we need to understand in order to really fully understand some of the relationships between human health and environmental change. So this is out of the IPCC, but just to say, really, the bits in yellow are essentially some of the aspects that they're risks that we can't do that much about, whereas the parts in red are really the bits that we can reduce through proper adaptation mechanisms. So when you go through the projected changes, you see that focusing sort of on some of the health effects related to water, undernutrition, for example, there is quite a lot that we can do through adaptation mechanisms to reduce the risks. The same goes for food and waterborne infections. There are lots of adaptation mechanisms that we can put in place to reduce those risks. So in the latest reports of IPCC, they looked at sort of key risks and adaptation issues and prospects that can come about. And so I just took out the Central and South America slide and the small island state slides, which will come later. But the two sort of things from the Central America slide, but that apply throughout, I think, is the issue of early warning systems. Now, in a project in Barbados that we have just concluded, where we were looking at dengue, we were trying to establish early warning systems, but it's extremely complex with the health data that we currently have often in small islands, because you need a certain amount of data in order to get statistically significant models, really, especially going into the future. And it became an issue of whether we use sort of laboratory confirmed cases of a disease, or whether we use proxies for a disease, and what implications that has, and what biases or what else we're bringing into the model if we don't use absolute sort of confirmed disease data. So, you know, there are issues with the early warning systems, but I think it is something that we need to work much more on. And also to bring out the issue of rainwater storage in water-scarce environments. There are issues that can come about by adaptation options on health. So in Barbados, back in the 90s, they introduced a planning policy related to rainwater storage, saying that buildings over a certain size needed to have rainwater storage capacity. But into their planning process, the sort of permissions that went along with it, they didn't introduce or they didn't specify whether those rainwater storage facilities had to have pumps or what the water could be used for. So as a result of which, we've had enormous proliferation of Aedes aegypti mosquitoes in Barbados, and the dengue problem has sort of gone out of control. So when we think about adaptation options, it's very important that we think about some of the other consequences that they could have, and make sure that we're looking at all of the pluses and the minuses that they could have, and what can we do with regard to the minuses, because sometimes they're very easy things to correct. So small island developing states, again, you know, this is projections. Often when we talk about small island states, the first thing that people talk about are the sea level rise. So just an example of one of the adaptation, I guess, options that Barbados went for was the construction of coastal zone protection on the south coast. But when they constructed it, they looked at it fairly broadly, and they didn't only build coastal zone protection, but they made it into a boardwalk. So they then increased the recreational use of that facility. It is a successful coastal zone protection, but it's also an extremely successful recreational area where people are walking, and in a country that has very high levels of non-communicable diseases, it has provided, you know, a very welcome avenue for people to exercise, to walk, where there are no cars, there's no danger from road traffic, vehicular accidents, and I mean, certainly during daytime hours is extremely well used. So some of the health outcomes of climate change, I've grouped them by health outcomes. excuse me. I'm clearly not going to go through all of them in the time that I have. I'm going to focus mainly on the ones that I regard as being related to water. So, you know, we've heard about the issues today of water in the right amount. But one of the things I wanted to bring is the aspect of water in the right amount isn't only about the provision of water now, but also with extreme weather events, it can destroy some of our provision of water. So the picture on the top right is the desalinization plant in Tacloban in the Philippines, which for the hospital, which was totally and utterly destroyed by the super typhoon Yolanda back in 2013. So their hospital suddenly had no water because there was no water coming in. And the destructive nature of extreme weather events can lead to challenges in the right access to the right amount of water, even when it was provided beforehand. But it's not only about water in the right amount, it's also about water in the right quality. As was mentioned earlier today, the MDG for provision of safe water has essentially been met in this region on paper. Although, as was discussed, there are many differences within each country, but there's also, especially in the Caribbean, that the infrastructure is aging and failing. And so when we were talking about water losses earlier, it means that there's a lot of breakages within the system. So even though you might have treated water being put into the system at the beginning, that is not what's coming out in people's houses. And so this then leads to lots of questions about, well, when we talk about the provision of safe water, yes, they have access to piped water, but is the water that's coming out of those pipes of a quality that we regard safe for human consumption? And the answer often is no. In Barbados, when they do measurements in people's houses, there's often zero chlorine residual in the water that's piped, although there is chlorine residual put in at the pumping stations. There are also cultural issues to do with chlorine in water, that people are starting to go against the idea of consuming chemicals, and they view having chlorinated water as introducing lots of chemicals into their diet that they don't necessarily want. And so there is a pushback against chlorination of water in the Caribbean. But this leads to all sorts of complications when it comes to health of the provision of safe water. So foodborne diseases and nutrition, with sea surface temperatures and sea surface patterns, things like cholera in the Caribbean can survive quite well in the water there. It's at the right pH, it's of the right temperature. And so following the outbreak of cholera in Haiti, there was then concern in the rest of the Caribbean chain about the potential for the introduction of cholera from the water. It's in mollusk food that the Caribbean people eat, And so quite a lot of work then went on in the other Caribbean countries down the line, even though they're not directly neighbours, because of the patterns that can come. Also, the storage of grains is something that in drought proliferant countries, people start to store grains more. And we know that with drought, there can be quite a lot of aflatoxin being produced and aflatoxin poisonings. When we talk about waterborne diseases, there are several waterborne diseases, such as ciguatera, that we know has neurological effects, that is expanding a lot in its geographical expanse. And so people need to start looking for these other diseases in places where traditionally they weren't necessarily found. The Southern Caribbean has never before really seen ciguatera, but now is starting to see. And I know that the Carolinas are also beginning to see ciguatera poisoning. So it's sort of expanding out from where people generally think of it as being. And also with urbanization, the changes in pollutants in water are increasing. And in islands where we do desalinization for consumption, if those pollutants are going in very close to desal plants, which take their water from fairly near to shore, then suddenly we're introducing pollutants into the water chain without necessarily thinking of that chain, because we just think it's going out into the sea, but we're not thinking about, well, we're actually taking seawater back to desalinate it. Regarding vector-borne and zoonotic diseases, I put this in there because a lot of people don't necessarily think of them as being waterborne diseases, and it's not necessarily from consumption of water, but as I mentioned earlier, when we store water in order to produce food, in order to have enough water to consume, we're also increasing the potential for Aedes aegypti proliferation. And not only that, that the climate change has an influence on not only the mosquitoes themselves, but also the viruses and the transmission cycles, the extrinsic incubation periods within the mosquito. So it really does, climate change and water really do have an impact on vector-borne and zoonotic diseases. So weather-related mortality and morbidity, with extreme hydrometeorological events, you can get a release of toxic chemicals from landfills when you get excessive precipitation. And this goes not only into the groundwater, but also into the seawater, which we then take back and desalinate. Raw sewage, the Caribbean still has a lot of septic tank systems, some of which are aging and not necessarily constructed for the population that is now using them. With extreme precipitation events, they can overflow. And so there is an issue not only in terms of the contamination of drinking water with the sewage, but also it's this is a part of the world which has enormous numbers of tourism, and tourists like to go and swim in the sea, and we are not, you know, the sewage is sometimes going into the sea following rainfall. So there is this challenge of you know, how do we do something about it without necessarily telling the tourists that they're swimming in water that has sewage in. And then the issue of food safety following extreme weather events. Not only food that comes in at the ports, food in supermarkets, food in stores, food in our own house, we sometimes keep it very low to the ground. Flooding can contaminate enormous amounts of food. In St. Lucia, following the flooding in December 2013, they had to get rid of all of their stocks of food that had come in for the supermarkets because it had all been contaminated because it was stored on the ground. The ships don't come in very often, so it then left them in a very precarious position of not having enough food to provide before that they could get another ship to come in. So correct storage of food is extremely important where you have these extreme weather events and flooding. And then sea level rise. Again, we've talked about some of this, but the point I want to point out is the coastal wells. Coastal wells are quite shallow in Barbados. We've had to close several of the pumping wells because they've become infiltrated with seawater, and so it's now saline because they're just so close to the sea, and as sea level goes up, that infiltration can be quite significant. So what can the health sector really do? Well, PAHO, WHO has a strategic plan and plan of action on climate change and health with four main areas: evidence, awareness raising, partnerships, and adaptation. And these are the four things that we try and look at. So with relation to evidence, it's the issue of vulnerability and adaptation assessments on a national level that we are really trying to focus on at the moment. And this also goes to adaptation, because you need to do the vulnerability and adaptation assessment to then plug into, well, what do you then do about it? How do you adapt? But if you don't know really what the vulnerable areas are, you can't adapt. So this is a process that we are currently doing in Dominica. And in Dominica, in the vulnerability assessment, we decided to focus really on vector-borne diseases, food safety and security, and on water quality, all of which are very related to issues of water. Dominica is not a water-scarce country by any stretch of the imagination, but it is a country that doesn't necessarily have even access to water, and a country that does suffer quite a lot from extreme weather events. So what we wanted to really do is assess the vulnerability in order to prioritise in programme planning to reduce the transmission of disease in the future. So it's a very intersectoral approach. Dominica has a National Climate Change Steering Committee, and so it's, which is made up of all of the different sectors of all of the different sectors that they believe are implicated in climate change in Dominica. And the Project Steering Committee includes not only the National Climate Change Steering Committee, but also the World Meteorological Organization, PAHO WHO, and Health Canada, and the Caribbean Institute for Meteorology and Hydrology. So I'm not going to go through all of these, but so what we did for each one, each sort of area, we looked at surveillance, exposure, sensitivity, and adaptations for vector-borne diseases, for waterborne diseases, and for food safety and security, to try and get an idea of really, with relation to those three things, where are the vulnerabilities in Dominica. It is still a work in progress, so I'm not going to share results with you because it's still ongoing. Some final thoughts, really. The bad news about adaptation is we can't really see the future clearly. And not all climate risks are avoidable, as I sort of mentioned earlier, but some of them are, or there's something that we can do about them to lessen the risks. So health continues often to be neglected in climate change support mechanisms. The funds awarded for health are often very, very small compared to the funds awarded to other sectors. But what are some of the potential explanations for that? And the health community is largely absent from the NAPA process at national level. And it's extremely important, as I've said, for adaptation strategies that health is also included and looked at, so that we don't have cases such as in Barbados, where we have a proliferation of Aedes aegypti coming from an adaptation option, where a very simple tool could have been put in place to stop that happening. With regard also to the early warning systems, the GEF project in that just recently concluded in Barbados, but it was part of a global project, and guidance was developed on establishing early warning systems as part of that project. And we hope that not only that guidance, but also the lessons learned from that project will help in the process of including health within the national processes. There are a lot of lessons learned from that process, and often, as we know, climate change generally resides in the Ministry of Environment or Ministry of Social Development, and so it's very important that linkage be made to health and health be included at the table. So what are some of the water solutions? Well, there are many that have been talked about earlier on in the presentations, but I want to highlight two, and that's one is this issue of the reuse of water. The reinjection of treated wastewater into aquifers or rainwater storage being reinjected into aquifers. These are all things that can be very difficult culturally for people to accept, and yet they can have huge benefits. So the photo I have there is of a project actually in Jordan, but which we had Barbados go and visit because they have a tomato greenhouse where they're using three different types of water in different rows of the tomatoes to show people that actually if you do the irrigation correctly, so if you have, you know, large irrigation efficiency, drip irrigation systems with barriers in between the water and the crops, you can use wastewater for irrigating plants that are for human consumption with no risk to health because the produce is not coming into contact with the water at any point in the system. So it goes back, you know, if we increase efficiency in irrigation and for the climate, but also use these biotechnologies, there are lots of things we can do with the water we already have and reuse it. And then the contentious issue of decreasing the amounts of meat in our diets, because we all know that meat uses an awful lot of water to consume. So the last slide I have is from FAO, where it looks at the amount of water needed to produce several items. So one beef steak requires 7,000 litres of water, whereas one potato is 25 litres of water. So yes, we need to have a balanced diet, but we also need to take account of some of the water issues and sustainability issues that go around with that. Thank you.